What you're about to hear, you may feel is totally unbelievable. But we're going to be talking about the secret space age. Olaf Phillips back with me on Coast to Coast AM. Wait till you hear this story. Stand by. And welcome back to Coast. Olaf Phillips is a conspiracy researcher specializing in the secret space program, exotic aircraft, high technology, mysterious civilizations as well. Olaf has written for Mysteries Magazine, served as an executive producer and principal researcher for our friend Ground Zero Radio's Clyde Lewis, a longtime contributor to Ground Zero, by the way, including the very famous Tracy, California case. Remember that? The UFO crash case that was featured on Bill Burns' UFO Hunters. Olaf, welcome back. Good to have you.
Well, it's good to be on.
You have done another marvelous job with the secret space age, but let's key in a little bit on just what have you been doing in the last 5, 6, 7 years than we last talked?
A lot of research.
Too much.
Too much research. I've written some articles, obviously, about the secret space program. Did some research into some mysterious hills here in the San Francisco Bay Area. A lot of things. I mean, I've tried to write, you know, on a variety of topics.
Your work, The Secret Space Age, keys in on a television show that occurred back in 1977 that was in Britain. And, you know, a lot of people, it was almost like War of the Worlds, but for TV. It was a shocking program, and I'll let you explain exactly what it was, because it scared the living daylights out of those people that saw it, didn't it?
It did, and you know, 40 years later, roughly 40 years, it's still scaring people today. But basically what happened was that there was a TV network called East Anglia TV, not a network, but a channel, and they had a long-running program called Science Report. And for the final episode of Science Report, they decided to do a show called Alternative 3. And it was originally supposed to be broadcast on April 1st in 1977, but due to a strike and some scheduling conflicts, they actually aired it in June. And before I get into what is in it, when they did air it, they actually simulcast it in Scandinavia and Australia. And within minutes of airing it, the switchboard lit up. And it just caused a huge problem.
It had to do with climate change, earth catastrophes, and what we were doing as a species to try to fight and defend ourselves for it, whether it was building underground cities or whatever. But the alternative three portion simply was, we have to leave this planet, wasn't it?
That's correct. So alternative one, the premise is that there's going to be some sort of climate disaster in the future, right? Whether it's man-made or cyclical, sometime in the future, the climate's going to collapse. The alternative one was to detonate a nuclear weapon at high altitude and to attempt to vent the carbon dioxide and other, you know, unfriendly gases into space. The second alternative was to build bunkers, and then the third alternative, as you said, was to leave.
And then you had some little halves, alternative halves, like 1.5 tossed in between.
Right. So when you look at Alternative 3, now it's important to understand that Alternative 3 as a television show was a hoax. I mean, it is not real. It was written and directed. You know, it had a fantastic soundtrack that was done by Brian Eno, who's a very famous electronica musician. There were some very famous people in it, like Tim Brenton and Shane Rimmer, who were very well known at the time. But the construct of it as a model is what's important. And the reason that I broke out the halves is that when you actually start to look at it as a blueprint, right, versus being real or not real, if you look at it structurally, that you can see where there are error corrections that were made. So, for example, Alternative 1 failed. Well, it half failed, but we can get into that. But Alternative 1 effectively failed. So that led the scientists that were involved in this to look at another option, and that's Alternative 1, which is climate engineering. Alternative 2 failed. So that because you can't build enough bunkers to hold the population of the world. So you have to look at a contingency plan. So the haves are contingency plans.
And, of course, the bunkers probably could be made for a select few.
Yeah, that's my notion, that when you look at the bunkers, and obviously there are some people out there who have done some amazing research on bunkers, like Richard Sauter and others, but when you look at the idea of the bunkers, you can't hold enough people. It would really only be the top echelons of society, whether it's determined by money, whether it's determined by, you know, scientific advancement, art, whatever your kind of selection process is, it becomes the creme de la creme, and the rest of humanity, so to speak, is kind of left out in the cold.
Why did so many people who saw this at the time in England, why did they think it was real?
I think because, unlike a lot of shows, I think it's because it makes sense, and I think it was designed to key into a lot of the things that people were worried about. You know, you're talking about the late 70s, so you're talking about oil embargoes and other things, and a lot the slow conversion from leaded gas to unleaded, you know, and this kind of notion that we need to start to take a look at the environment. But it actually goes, the plan itself goes far earlier than that. But I think it was designed to scare people because it keyed in on things that they would understand. The brain drain, for example, that they talk about in Alternative 3 was very real. You know, this idea that people were leaving England at the time to go work in other countries because they could get paid more money. You know, they had a massive loss of scientific talent. So it's very plausible. I think that's what scares people.
Well, the people who wrote it, I mean, they, as far as I'm concerned, looked into the future, all of, didn't they?
They did. And I think that's the unsettling part. And, you know, David Ambrose and Christopher Miles, who actually wrote it, you know, they say, along with Leslie Watkins, by the way, who wrote the book treatment, they say that although nobody told them what to write, that they believe they got shockingly close to something that's real. So, you know, they themselves admit that it's almost like a time machine.
And a scary one. Now, how did they film this? Was this on grainy film and it made it look even more presentable as something real?
Yeah, they shot it on film. In fact, that's one of the interesting parts of the story, is that after Alternative 3 was made, that there was a fire which actually destroyed all the master reels of Alternative 3, and the only surviving master copy is in the possession of Christopher Miles.
Yeah, that's what that was a great selling point, wasn't it?
It is. It definitely is. There's not... Supposedly, you can't get a copy, although I have heard, and I do have a copy off of a master, and I've heard that it's kind of hit and miss, that if you go to ITV, who owns East Anglia now, if you go to ITV and request a copy, they'll tell you it was destroyed. But depending on who you talk to and depending on who you are, sometimes a mysterious DVD will appear in the mail that's basically a master copy.
So Alternative 3, let's go through that, basically says that the planet is dying. We need to evacuate. We've got to go somewhere. We got to get off this planet. You're not going to be able to live underground. We're going to the moon or we're going to Mars. And people actually believe that back in 77?
They did. They actually did. The switchboard lit up, and it actually led to a law being passed in a number of countries where you can't, number one, you can't show Alternative 3. And the second part was that you couldn't create a War of the Worlds style broadcast.
Whoa.
So, you know, it was very, it had quite an impact. In fact, I think the only country in the world that you can actually air Alternative 3 on television today is Japan.
It never aired here, did it?
It didn't. The head of NBC Drama at the time saw it in England and was so impressed with it that he actually bought the rights to air it in North America. And when he came back to the United States and took it to Standards and Practices, which are the censors of the TV channels, when he took it to Standards and Practices, they said that it was too dangerous to air and they refused to let him air it.
How long did it run in terms of length?
I think it's like 52 minutes.
That's all?
Yeah, it's a one-hour show, and the way they do commercials is a little different there. Instead of, you know, in the United States and Canada, when we do commercials, you know, like two or three times during a show. In England, they show commercials at the beginning before the show starts. They show the episode. Halfway through, they say, okay, we're taking a break, show commercials. Then they show the other half. So they really only modify their airtime for a very short window in the beginning and at the end for commercials. And then in the center is kind of your commercial block. So I think it's like 50 minutes or 52 minutes. It's under an hour.
So it's... With that being that short a show, they must have done an astounding job, Olav, to get people scared.
Absolutely astounding. I mean, when you watch it, even if you don't buy into the conspiracy of it, just the of it, how they made it, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
How did you?
The acting is okay, but the way that it was made is brilliant, and the way that they cap off the show, the very ending of the show is. I mean, you can't ask for a better slam dunk.
How did you key in on this? I mean, you focal pointed this with the Secret Space Age, your book. How did you come up with this?
So early on, I was a film geek, and like most people, I had a 12th or 20th generation copy of Alternative 3 that was VHS transfer, so it was incredibly grainy. I guess I kind of added to it. That it was very broken up and grainy. But I watched it, and at the time, approaching it from a film geek point of view, you know, I thought it was humorous in places. It's a little cheesy. And I thought, you know, this is mechanically very interesting film, right? But over time, the more I watched it, the more I started to ask myself, you know, this is too accurate. There's,
yeah.
It's too detailed. I mean, it's very detailed.
They were very good.
They were very good, and, you know, I started to read and try to understand it, and one day it dawned on me, I said, you know, if this is actually accurate, then you should be able to trace it. You should be able to look at each alternative, look at all these things that they talk about in the show, the secret meeting, you know, and then the alternatives that they come up with, and you should be able to find them actually happening, and I did, and it was a very shocking revelation.
How do we know that some of the things in this show aren't real?
Well, you know, Tim Brinton, for example, was a very famous television presenter. He was kind of a news host. But in England, they have a rule where you can't be a presenter and be an actor. So he was a presenter to become an actor. And I think that's part of what gave it its authenticity at the time, that Tim Brinton, it would kind of be like Walter Cronkite coming on and telling you the world's going to end.
Right, and they believed him. They believed anything he said, right?
That's right. That's right. But, you know, the actors, they're actors. Some of the actors are better than others. Shane Rimmer, who plays Bob Grodin, he's a very good actor. He was in a lot of science fiction films at the time. But some of the others, you know, their acting styles are... they range from pretty good to pretty poor. So, you know, when you watch it, you can tell that the film you're watching is not real. But as I said, it's mechanically, I think it's real.
Now let's talk about how they planned to escape and move on. Now here's the thing. Did they convince people in 1977 that this was going on now, that we had a program in place to evacuate the planet?
I believe that they did. According to my research, I think it actually started in the late 50s. That there was this is where it becomes real, right? That in the late 50s there was a meeting of the American Chemical Society, and in that meeting there was a guy named Roger Revelle, and Roger Revelle worked for the Scripps Oceanographic Institute, and his main topic was the fact that he, according to his analysis, the phytoplankton and these animals that kind of live at sea that process carbon dioxide and other kinds of gases and convert them into oxygen, they're kind of like natural air scrubbers. His contention was that they would be overpowered by the early 60s, that the amount of gases that they were expected to process, that they could actually only process 10% of what it was anticipated.
Wow. Well, and we lucked out there, didn't we?
Well, so based on that, you're going to start to have a greenhouse style effect start to take place, even in the early 60s. And one, within a year or two of that meeting, then suddenly there's this rush to carry out a nuclear weapons test. You know, it's, I mean, it's almost...
Well, see, and now if there was a nuke detonated in the atmosphere, it would create an EMP, pulse it, and wipe us out in terms of our power grid.
And you know, they were very, they very carefully selected where they did this. But it was actually way out in the Atlantic, and it's the highest nuclear detonation ever. But what's interesting is that when you look at it, seeing it as being alternative one, right, that they actually planned, carried out, and left the project. It was called Operation Argus. They actually did it in a quarter of the time that it normally takes. So normally it would take up to 2 years to plan a nuclear test. They did it in under a year. They did it in like 6 months.
The bases that they talked about in that film, were they already constructed? I mean, did they convince people we had bases on the moon and Mars?
The people who were calling in, who were scared out of their minds, were definitely convinced. I think that the research would show you that we had bases by the 70s.
Oh, that's amazing that people believe that then. I mean, today, if somebody said today, we've got bases on the moon and we've been on Mars, you know, I would say that 60 to 70% of the people would say, all right, I believe that. We probably do. But to believe it back then, I guess, you know, 8 years after we landed on the moon, they probably thought that was probable, huh?
Well, I think part of it is also the you know, the mechanics of the film. The film was brilliantly made. And the last, I'd say the last 4 minutes of the film, you see a landing on Mars.
How can we go see this now?
You can watch it on YouTube. There are a number of places that you can see it. It's pretty easy to find if you want to find it.
And you just put in Alternative 3?
Yeah.
Okay. And, I mean, is it the actual film that that they played in 77?
It is the actual film that they played in 77.
So it'll show the host coming out and scaring the living daylights out of it.
Absolutely.
When you look at this today, Olav, what goes through your mind in terms of what's going on with our secret space program? Because I'm convinced we have one.
Right. When I look at it today and I watch it and I start to think about it, it changed my perspective. I mean, like many people, when I first got into this kind of research, you know, I thought that all UFOs were alien and, you know, there's things going on and, you know, secret underground bases, back engineering things. And although I still believe that we're back engineering some alien aircraft, I think a lot of the things that we see in the sky that are unexplainable are actually of human origin. And I think a lot of them tie back to Alternative 3.
I think you're right. I think a lot are human origin, but you've always got that few, that minute percent that might not be.
Well, J. Allen Hynek and Jacques Vallée, you know, they kind of say that there's about 10%, right, that are truly unexplainable.
To me, all you need is 1%.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, if 1% of them are alien, then, you know, we definitely have something that we should be looking at.
We are going to come back in just a moment as we continue talking about the secret space age right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, do you believe we have a secret space program? That we might have had one going on for years? You'll have your time to chime in next hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back as we talk more about the secret space age on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Olav Phillips with us. His website, anomalies.net. Linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, talking about his thoughts on the secret space age. And I've got to go look at Alternative 3 now, Olav. You've got me so into this, I've got to see it.
Well, I think that once you watch it, especially given the topics that you discuss, I think once you watch it, you'll start to see it. You know, it takes a few times, but if you're very familiar with the topics, which I know you are, then it'll just pop out at you.
Let's go through some of the things that you put in the book, The Secret Space Age, and weigh what could actually be going on here. In your opinion, How far have we gone with this?
I think that there's compelling evidence that we've made it to Mars. I think that if you look at photos of Mars and you look at photos of the moon, there's definitely structures on the moon, and there's a very vibrant community of people talking about the, you know, the fake moon landing.
Yeah.
I think that that plays into it. But there are some structures, and they're very hard to find, but there are structures on Mars that are very clear.
And do you think they're ours?
Yes, I do.
Ah, okay. Now, but do you believe in extraterrestrial life, don't you?
I do, absolutely. And I think that the Drake equation, that notion that if you we can mathematically predict that there has to be life out there, that really seals the deal for me. But, you know, when I see things, I've seen things in the sky that I can't explain that a human pilot didn't do. You know, so I'm a firm believer that at least 10% of them are unknown, and they're probably alien.
What do we have going on around the planet in terms of in orbit?
Well, there's a variety of things. There's SDI, the Reagan-era initiative to put weapons into space. You know, there's some compelling evidence that, that the SDI program was indeed launched. In fact, I had an amazing conversation with a gentleman once where he was telling me about a project he worked on called Space Warden. And, you know, our conversation got touched short before I got all the details I wanted, but it was a fascinating conversation. So I definitely think there's that. The Soviets had launched three separate battle stations into orbit called the Almaz. We had a program called the MOL, the Manned Observation Laboratory, which was a counterpart to Almaz. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff floating around up there that we have no idea what it is.
If we went to Mars and set up those structures, are we still there, or did we abandon the planet?
I think that, that if we went to the trouble to put them there, I suspect we're probably still there. I mean, ultimately, you know, the key to the book, right, is to try to understand the end game of the secret space program. 1,001 people have done amazing work proving that the secret space program exists. I threw my hat in to throw in a few things that I thought were interesting about it as well. But there's a lot of evidence that it exists. But what is lacking, and what is generally lacking from conspiracy research, is this idea of an end game. What's the end result? I mean, people don't do things for free, right? There has to be a purpose. And money and power isn't the purpose of all this. So, you know, based on that, I looked for a plausible option. And, you know, that's alternative three. And so if we're going to go to all this trouble in spanning more than 50 years of preparing for this kind of thing to happen, you know, it would be really sad if, you know, if you at the crowning moment that you say, well, I don't want to live here after all, it's too rusty and the air smells funny and I want to go home. You know, you commit to a path in this kind of a scenario, and you kind of have to stick with it. So I think we're definitely there.
Gary McKinnon, who's in England and has managed to avoid extradition to the United States, tapped into the NASA computer system, which is what really got him in hot water. What was he looking for? He claims he wanted UFO information.
Yeah, he says that he wanted proof of you know, UFOs are real, and that he wanted to get into Roswell. I mean, everybody wants to know about Roswell. But what he actually found, and this is where it's interesting when you think about it, what he actually found were the leftovers of the secret space program, right? He found transfer orders. He found manifests. You know, he didn't find, he says he found one picture that was in the process of being airbrushed by NASA, but he didn't find, like, schematics of battle stations and schematics of starships and, you know, flight logs and all this kind of stuff. He found that minutia that people don't care about. If you think about sitting at your desk and, you know, every day you're processing things and you might have purchase orders go across your desk and you sign off on them. Yeah, you know, we got our 55-gallon drums today or whatever, and you kind of shove it along. That's what he found. And that's interesting because that's what you would find, right?
You would think.
Yeah.
You would think. But, man, they want his head, don't they?
They wanted to put him in prison for 70 years. He was up to go to Guantanamo as an enemy of the United States. I mean, they were really throwing the full weight of the Department of Justice at this guy. I mean, they didn't even do that for Kevin Mitnick.
No. Good old Kevin, one of our dear friends and a good guest here. But no, you're absolutely right. Now they've cut a deal with him, basically. You know, he supplies information. He's training them.
Exactly. And here's a guy who actually did break into DOD computer systems. He did malicious things, not that malicious, but, you know, he did things. He left them notes. He taunted them. And, you know, now he's working for them, right? But here's Gary McKinnon. You know, does this whole thing on a 56K modem, only finds a few little things, and then they're after him. I mean, they want him dead.
So let's go into some other things that you have looked at. The SDI satellite. Remember the STS-48? Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Explain what people were seeing. Were they looking at that video?
Sure. So when you watch STS-48, what you're seeing is the space shuttle is rolled over and its cargo bay is looking toward the Earth, right? When you watch the film, what you see is a small dot move from outside of the atmosphere in toward the planet, and then it kind of makes a turn, and then there's a flash, and then it turns around and leaves. Then what you see is another dot go after it, and then the last thing you see is a like a longer white thing that kind of moves across the field of the camera. Now, at that point, the mission control in Houston told the STS-48 to execute the maneuver, and basically they rolled the shuttle back over and killed the feed. And I think that what you're seeing when you watch that footage is you're watching an object coming in, then something happens. I don't know what the flash is, but it turns around to take off. You see another object go after it, and then I think you see an SDI system firing something at it. And that would be the long white thing that kind of shoots through the field of view.
Yeah, it's truly remarkable. Truly remarkable.
It is.
I mean,
it is. It's insane to watch it. I mean, when you realize what you're looking at, you know, it's actually insane. I mean, it's proof.
I mean, clearly something was shot at and something escaped.
Yeah, I mean, something went after it and something fired at it. I mean, I think that that's pretty compelling to me. And to me, when I watched it, I thought to myself, you know, that's SDI. I mean, there's nothing else in orbit that would be firing at stuff, right? SDI was the only thing that we've ever, you know, well, we supposedly didn't launch it, but it's the only thing we've ever contemplated that was some sort of a weaponization of space, right? So it would have to be SDI.
How many other nations are doing secret space programs, in your opinion?
Well, I think that if you see it as a construct, that I think it's pretty much all the major nations are complicit in it. I think that the Russians, then Soviets, you know, Western Europe, Asia, you know, and I mean, we know even today that the Chinese space station, that they've used it for military operations. You know, I think that most of the major nations are complicit in it. I mean, they would have to be. I mean, if you look at alternative 1.5, this idea of solar radiation management and chemtrails and all that, in order for that to function, it would have to be a worldwide effort. You can't just spray North America, or you can't just spray Europe, or you can't just spray Asia. You've got to spray everything in order for it to work. So I think it is a global operation.
Tell me what you think of Project Serpo, which was supposed to be a transferring of astronauts and extraterrestrials back and forth.
You know, Serpo is a very controversial topic. There are a lot of people that go one way or the other. I mean, to me, when I see Serpo, I see disinformation, right? And one of the tenets of disinformation is this notion of the golden thread. So I think that the idea that we're transferring people to another planet, and that gets into the whole Close Encounters thing and Holloman and all that, you know, I think that the Serpo part of it is probably not true. But I think the idea that the people are going up into space to do something and they're being transferred around, you know, in space is totally plausible. And that would be the golden thread. See, in disinformation, in order for good at disinformation to work, right, the root of it has to be true. The root of it has to be real.
Yeah, there's got to be some truth to it.
There's a nugget, and they call that the golden thread. And if you look at Project Serpo, I think the golden thread is us doing stuff in space.
Well, you may be right there. What's the end game?
Well, I think the end game is survival. I think it transcends money, power. I think it's survival. That whatever this incoming problem is, whether it's climate, and I mean our climate is changing drastically, but whether it's climate or it's an asteroid like Apophis or whatever that end thing is that's going to destabilize our atmosphere and destabilize our planet, you know, at that point, all you have left is survival. So I think this is about survival. And I think that it's self-serving in some ways that there are a bunch of people who are signing the checks or saying, I want to survive this. And I think there's a greater good of, you know, we need to maintain some sort of remnant of who we are. I think that that's part of that arc, kind of arc notion. I think that that's part of it as well. But it's definitely survival. I don't think that it's somebody who just wants to go to Mars or the moon or, you know, I don't think it's scientific. I think ultimately it comes down to survival. And that's well within the alternative three scenario.
You have looked at other paranormal, supernatural events. I mean, you just came back from a CSETI meeting where? Up in the state of Washington?
That's correct.
What'd you look for? Bigfoot?
No, actually, I didn't go there specifically for Bigfoot. I went there to see strange stuff in the sky. I mean, CSETI is famous for having strange aerial phenomenon, and that's right up my alley. So, you know, I went there to see strange airplanes. What I saw was strange things in the sky, and I saw some really bizarre lights on that mountain, Mount Adams, and I think I might have seen Bigfoot.
Now, what do you mean you think you might have seen it?
Well, let me first say that I'm not a cryptozoologist, and I had no intention of seeing Bigfoot. You know, I never thought in my entire life I would ever see Bigfoot. But I was sitting at a table with one of my friends, Larry Overman, and he starts hitting me and saying, hey, look at the mountain, look at the mountain. And I said, no, you know, the fun stuff happens at night. I just want to sit here. And no, you got to look, you got to look. And so what we saw is that about probably about 11,000 feet, I saw two things that were probably a quarter of an inch high that were black walking, and you could actually see them moving. And I saw them walking up the side of a snowfield. And the snowfield was at about a 40 or 45 degree angle. The reason that it's important is that I was 14 miles away from the mountain. So I'm 14 miles away, and they're at roughly 11,000 feet. So for me to see something even a quarter of an inch high means that whatever that was had to be astronomical. I mean, according to our napkin map, we figure it was about 12 feet tall.
Did anybody else see this with you?
No, just Larry and I, and we watched it for about 40 minutes.
Any video?
I have photos, but they're, you know, I got them on my iPhone, so they're not great.
Right.
They're just little black things moving up the mountain.
Little blips, but clearly you could tell that something out there.
It was, they were way too big to be people. I mean, we couldn't even see people. You know, the trees, enormous trees to us, were just very small. And what's interesting is that we actually watched them walk up the side of the mountain, and when they got to the top, there was kind of a ledge before you made the final ascent to the very top of the mountain. And we could actually see them standing there. And we could see them walking along the ledge. You can actually see them moving up and down that kind of gait that you get when you're walking. I mean, it was mind-boggling.
Well, there's something out there, Olav. Something is there. People are reporting seeing very strange things.
Well, Sea City is a great place. I mean, if you want to see some strange stuff, we saw some extremely strange things. In fact, I think we may have seen an aurora, which is a top secret aircraft.
Right.
So see, but
you're a believer that most of this is ours, right?
That's correct. I think a lot of it is ours. And I think they're not just ours, but I think that ours being human, I think there might be a competing breakaway civilization, so to speak, that's functioning at the same time. So it's human. Some of it's from here. Some of it's from nearby. But, you know, I think a lot of it is human.
Of everything you've investigated to date, what has been for you the most fascinating episode?
That's a hard one. You know, I saw some things that E-SETI that really blew my mind. I think from a research point of view, I think it's probably alternative three, but more like the SDI stuff and the moon bases. Until I really started to investigate it, I never really understood the level of planning that had gone into potentially putting bases on the moon. And we're not talking NASA. You know, in the 80s, when I was a kid, I remember watching those kind of NASA films where you probably remember where they had, like, the space shuttle, and there's, like, a runway on the moon, and they're landing, and big NASA symbols everywhere. These are more military. And I think that kind of boggled my mind. But stuff that I've actually seen, probably some of the things that I saw at E-SETI, really, really blew my mind.
Well, they've done a great job out there, haven't they?
Oh, amazing. And they're wonderful hosts. You know, they help you out. They tell you, you know, these are the areas that are really active. Go look over there. Because the night sky up there is huge. So it's kind of awe-inspiring that you look, you know, you can see almost from horizon to horizon. So trying to pick little dots moving around, you know, it's very difficult. So, you know, they kind of point to places and go, there's stuff over there. But after you've watched it for a while, you kind of get a feeling for how it traverses that a lot of the, what I would suspect are exotic aircraft were flying from the southeast toward the north. The aurora that we saw came out of the southeast and kind of headed west. But a lot of the more exotic aircraft were coming out of the southeast and flying north. And then a lot of the stranger stuff was flying kind of east to west.
You've looked at the Admiral Byrd story about going into the center of the Earth, right?
I have.
Do you believe that?
I don't know if he went to the center of the Earth. I mean, it's something. His statements after going to the North Pole, to the South Pole, were very enigmatic. It's very unclear what he actually did. I suspect that he actually had a fight while he was there. But there, you know, what he said, some of the statements that he made could make you go in the direction that he went into the center of the Earth and the hollow Earth theory. Sure.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, and we'll take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.